This episode's guest is Chris Carmichael. Chris is the founder and CEO of CTS, a pioneering company in the endurance coaching industry. Celebrating its 20th anniversary in 2020, CTS has worked with more than 20,000 amateur and professional athletes and grown to a coaching staff of more than 50 coaches in three locations nationwide. Chris was a member of the 1984 Olympic team and the iconic 7-Eleven pro cycling team. I'm psyched to talk about that. There's going to be some interesting stories from there. And is a best-selling author of more than 10 books on training and nutrition, including The Time Crunch Cyclist and The Time Crunch Triathlete. Coached to the U.S. Olympic team, cycling team in 1992 and 96, he was named the U.S. Olympic Committee Coach of the Year in 99. Chris is a columnist for Road Bike Action magazine and writes a weekly training blog with more than 70,000 subscribers. He was a longtime columnist for a bicycling magazine, Outside magazine, Velo News, and Triathlete magazines. Chris and CTS have been the trusted coaching resource for amateur athletes, as well as national, world, and Olympic champions. So, Chris, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me, Ken. I appreciate it.
So tell us a little bit about who Chris is from your own mouth. You know, we were chatting a little bit prior. We know a number of the same people, but I'd love to hear, you know, your description of yourself.
Let's see. I started bike racing a long time ago, 1969. I was 9 years old when I did my first bike race. And I was really fortunate that I grew up in South Florida because of this strong Cuban influence. Bike racing was really popular there. And there was a really good kind of infrastructure of racing, coaching, training, all that. In the late 60s, early 70s. And that, you know, is one of those things that if you grew up probably in, you know, Lincoln, Nebraska, probably in, you know, in the late 60s, having bike races every weekend and coaches and training rides probably didn't really exist much. But so I was really fortunate to grow up there. And then I progressed up through the ranks and made it onto the junior worlds team. And then went over to Europe and raced a lot in Europe, living there in Belgium for quite a while and with the national team. And then, you know, was selected to the 7-Eleven team. And when we first went to Europe in 95, what was it? It was 85. I want to say 95, but that 10 years, it was long before that. So we were kind of the bad news bears there and didn't know what we were doing, but we actually got a few wins. And so proud of all that. And then I unfortunately had a bad injury and broke my femur in multiple places. And that was eventually the end of my pro racing career, but that got me into coaching. And I was fortunate because I think I'm was and still a better coach than I was an athlete.
No, in 2000 is probably when the world of coaching really took off, right? There wasn't really much before that. And the advent of the internet must've changed that whole world.
It did. The internet was very helpful. I was with US Cycling as the national coaching director up to 1998. And I left in 98 and basically was consulting with a few companies and was I had athletes that were asking me if possible I could coach them and what that would look like. And I started to realize that there was really this, there needed to be a solution with helping sort of the amateur athlete reach goals they have. And before, in the 90s, if you were a cycling coach in the 1990s, the only cycling coaches who really made a living, I'm sure there were a few others, but the vast majority were national team coaches. And those were the six or seven coaches that I had hired that were working with the U.S. cycling team at the time. And it just seemed like there was a lot of people buying expensive bikes, doing century rides, a lot of people that wanted guidance and how they could perform better on the bike. And there was nobody really servicing them. I think Bicycling Magazine, you know, was really it. And, you know, we all know Bicycling Magazine is kind of the sort of just a fluffed down version of, you know, it's like,
it's a consumer version of like Rod and a Bike.
No, it's just one of those type things that you don't look at it and go, oh, I gleaned all kinds of information from there and that's going to help me perform better. So I saw that there was a need and I started the company and reached out, got pretty much, I was really nervous when we started. We had two coaching packages, and like any entrepreneur, the thing that you're most nervous about is, will anybody buy your product? Will anybody come into your store? And kind of right away we were overwhelmed and I had to get more coaches in and recruit more coaches. So that's a luxury problem, but still a problem, you know? Mm-hmm. And so fortunate things kind of took off. The internet was very helpful because it allowed us to do this remote coaching, looking at people's, at that time it was heart rate data, some power files, but most of that was not delivered via the internet. Most of the time at that time, you were getting readouts via a fax. And we were looking at it via a fax, you know, and then you would develop the training programs and communicate via phone. And now that's all, you know, gone to the wayside.
Now you just grab an iWatch and download it. You don't even have to do anything, right? It's all real-time data. It's sort of crazy to see of, you know, with technology and what's happening. How has technology changed your coaching by doing, like you were saying, power meter stuff or doing, you know, less heart rate stuff, but, you know, all different types of, you know, you can pretty much measure everything at this point. But what are you guys mostly measuring right now?
Well, it depends upon the sport. The cycling is our biggest sport, but you know, running is really strong for us as well, and triathlon. But you know, I think where the biggest influence has been is in the software that allows us to analyze the device files, whether it's a GPS file or a power meter file, or you know, in along with heart rate data and you know, terrain and all that. It's really the, you know, Training Peaks has some great software, and WKO5 allows us to slice up that data and really dig in as deep as you want to go as a coach. And I prefer to keep it kind of simple and look at the things that I know bring me the most value, and analyzing an athlete's training data, and then be able to manipulate their training program based upon that data. But it's really that the software now is so powerful, you can really look at really any question you have about training. You now have a way to dig in and hopefully find those answers. And along the way, you'll probably get a lot more questions that will come up.
And then we'll be loading chips under our skin and it'll just tell us everything else next, right? probably not far away.
Yeah.
So let's go back to the 7-Eleven thing. That's a fascinating time. You guys were, you know, I've been around cycling enough and sort of know the history of that and everything. And that had to be an exciting time going over there. You guys were crashing the party, but doing pretty well.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. When we first came to Europe with 7-Eleven, basically people didn't even know that the other athletes didn't even know we were who we were, or, you know, like, did we even belong in the race? Was it a mistake that we were somehow there? And we got blamed for if there was a crash anywhere in the Peloton, you know, and we weren't even near it, we got blamed for it. But we also got some wins, you know. I mean, right away in our first campaign to Europe in the spring, you know, Ron Kiefel won Trofeo Laguaglia, which is the opening race on, it's a one-day race on the Italian pro racing calendar. And that opened the door for getting Hunved as the sponsor for the team for the Tour of Italy later on in the year. And we went to the Giro in 85, and Andy Hampson won a stage, Ron Kiefel won a stage. And I think just about everybody finished the race, and that was really sort of a kind of a breakthrough event for us. And after that, we were then well known in the pro peloton. We were requested to participate in basically all the events on the pro calendar. We got an invite to the Tour de France for 86. And it just kind of took off. And there really was at that time, U.S. cycling, the mainstay of it was criteriums in the U.S. And you know, Davis Finney was really known as sort of his nickname was the cash register, and for winning preens in these criteriums, and the 7-Eleven team was really known as a criterium team. And that's mainly because we didn't have many events that weren't a series of criteriums. Even the Coors Classic in Colorado had some road races, but it was mainly a lot of criteriums and circuit races. So it was new for us to go to Europe, and many of us had been there racing on the national team, but racing with the pros in events that or 250, 260 kilometers was obviously a stretch for us, but there was a lot of talent. I mean, Greg LeMond led the way, but he was kind of, I was on the Junior Worlds team with him, and we did some national team events as well, but he was sort of the anomaly, you know. I mean, Greg was just like this, you know, in his own league. And the rest of us were kind of the mere mortals, so to speak. And Greg was doing his thing, but we realized with others that we felt we were competitive with, that we could race with them, and we were getting results. So we didn't really have a lot of guidance at that time, but in certain ways that was helpful because.
Right.
Sort of like, you know, if we knew what we were actually facing, we might have been scared. And we just kind of faced it the way we faced other competitions here in the U.S. It was like, I remember talking before, we had a team meeting before Trofeo Laguaglia, which Ron Kiefel won. And we said, oh, you know, Ron was really good at like a 3-kilometer sprint to uphill sprint to the line, and Trofeo Laguaglia finished up this climb of about 2K to this town, not real hard, but it was definitely uphill. And so we looked at it, we talked about it, and we said, look, let's just all line up about 20K going into it, to the finish, stretch it out, get everybody at the front, and we'll drop Wookiee off. That was his nickname. Everybody had nicknames. And we'll drop Wookiee off about 2K from the line, and he'll take off and do his Wookiee sprint and win. And we're like, yeah, let's do it. And that's exactly what we did. And it worked. And he won.
Which is unbelievable. What were the speeds like going from the US to Europe? Was it faster? Was it just different? What was it like racing in Europe versus the US back then? I'm sure it's the same even today.
Yeah, definitely. Italy was kind of funny because there's no flat races in pro racing in Europe. You know, there just isn't. You know, everything's got at least, you know, it depends upon the race, but nothing is like dead flat. And we in the U.S. you had a lot of races that were pretty much dead flat. You had some that were hilly and mountainous, but many were not on the same terrain that you faced in Europe. And so that was the initial big challenge. And in the distance, you know, I mean, long stages or long races for us in the US may have been 80 miles, or maybe you'd have a 100-mile race, but they were kind of far and few between. And in the pro peloton, there was really no races that were really under 100 miles, you know, and most were 200K to 250K and really different. And they say in Belgium, like, you know, if I get this right, if I remember it, you know, there's a saying that basically 99% of the peloton is good for the first 200 kilometers, and then the next 50 kilometers, a 0.5% is good, and then that last 0.5% is from 250 to 270, and that's where the race is won. It's just those last, you know, it comes down to like three or four guys that are good at the end like that. And you can see it now, you know, in power files, and you can really see the difference between the guys that can put out the power at the end versus the guys that can do it only in the first 200K, let's say.
Right.
It's a big difference.
And while they're probably the smarter ones too, or the protected ones, right, as well.
That's true.
Makes a big difference. Now, funny thing is, you're talking about the length and the hills. I think you've probably been here. I actually live in the town that the Fitchburg stage race, the mountain stage, was in. So going through Princeton Center, multiple laps. So I'm sure you're familiar with that. So let's shift gears a little bit. And a lot of the listeners are listening or looking for coaching, right? Or looking for advice. And you wrote a couple books, The Time Crunch Cyclist and The Time Crunch Triathlete. Talk to us a bit about, you know, sort of the premise of those books and how people can, you know, effectively train being in a time crunched world or a COVID world that we're in right now.
Yeah, that's a good question, Ken. You know, when we developed the time crunch training kind of protocols, we did an analysis of what we were doing at CTS and the athletes and the structure of training we were utilizing. And basically we were utilizing the periodization structure for training. And that's a proven model, works well. But you know, it's really based upon you being a professional athlete and you having virtually all day to train.
Right.
And,
10 to 2, 10 to 3, right? Most people don't have that.
Yes. And it, exactly. And we realized that, you know, that training volume, the amount of time you spend on the bike is really important for an athlete. There's a lot of really good adaptations that occur when you push the volume out and keep the training intensity relatively low as you're pushing that volume out. But, you know, for many of us, training 25 hours in the week is really challenging to do.
Right.
You know, we got something called a job that gets in the way. And so going out and doing sort of a lot of base training and putting in that foundation for a lot of athletes that were well experienced that had been doing it for a long time, but they didn't have really more than 8 hours that they could train in the week. They really weren't going to get any positive physiological adaptations from going out and putting in 2 hours of easy kind of foundation riding. Now, if you could get in 6 hours, great. You know, and we could do it the next day and the next day. So we started looking at it and realized that, hey, where can we get the greatest adaptations for the least amount of training time? And we looked at two physiological aspects that we wanted to develop. One was VO2 max. It's the rate, in essence, that you're delivering oxygen to your muscles. And the next was your power at lactate threshold. And that's where you, this threshold, and there's some I wouldn't say debate, but that threshold, what is threshold and how do you define it? There's, you know, there's a lot of people that look at it and, but what we look at is, you know, where you cross over from using fat and carbohydrate as your fuel source to using just carbohydrate, right at that threshold. And if we can increase our power there and improve our VO2 max, your chance of doing better in an endurance sport goes up dramatically. So we focus on training intensity. We look at trying to develop the VO2 max first, grow out that engine, try to also get some adaptations from lactate buffering and things like that that occur when you're doing these short, very intense efforts. They're not easy efforts. It's kind of that light, hot intensity, as hard as you can go for about up to about 3 minutes in repeated efforts. And then we'll shift the training after a little bit to focus on improving that power at that lactate threshold. And those are longer efforts at a little lower intensity level. That's more building that sort of sustainability. And when we do that, and then also we're able to measure that very effectively on a bike with a power meter. And so we can start to see, are we getting the positive adaptations that we need from the athlete? We can also clearly address when we need to get built-in recovery before we start the next training block to get those adaptations again, put that training load back on the athlete. So it's very easy to manipulate the training to get the best return by doing this type of training. And our athletes responded really well, and the vast majority of our athletes are on 6, 8, maybe 10 hours a week of training. Now, there's some limits to this type of training. If you're going to be doing some really long endurance races, well, we need to build some of that into your training. And you're good up to about 3 hours, but we need to build some of that endurance in. It's also very easy to if you're not giving yourself adequate recovery between those hard bouts of training, it's really easy to overtrain. But the nice thing is, if you've got a power meter, the right software, we can clearly see when you need recovery and before we need to add another hard training session when the athlete's ready to handle that. So the big news on our side is we got about 12% gains across the board with our athletes at power at threshold. And if you go, well, what's 12% at, you know, if your threshold was 200 watts before, you know, now you're, you know, close to 225 watts, 25 watts, you know, 20 to 25 watts difference. To add on a thread is a big difference, really helpful. It's the difference between getting dropped on the hill and not getting dropped, or getting, you know, dropped on the hill and dropping others on the hill.
It's the difference between an e-bike and a non-e-bike, right? It's you have your own e-bike built in at that point.
Yeah, could be, yeah.
What about, you know, during this whole, you know, we're talking right now and during the COVID pandemic, we're in different phases. I think, you know, the weather's changing and people want to get outside, but how are people training virtually, right? Sort of the e-piece of it, the Zwift, the Peloton piece. I'm sure, are you guys training people using those tools? How is that whole thing working? Because if you see, you know, Ironman doing stuff and so many different players are doing it. So talk to us a little bit about what's going on there. And it's opening up a whole new world of racing too.
It is. It is. And it's really fascinating, you know, to I grew up with sort of just despising riding indoors.
It's awful. It's awful. I can tell you the last day I rode a long ride indoors is 1997 during a snowstorm, and I won't do it ever again.
Yeah. And now there's basically, you know, there's teams that's all they do is race, you know, indoors. And it's amazing how far it's come, the technology. We train a lot of people that just stay indoors, and it's not obviously, you know, with the COVID-19 crisis, that's the quarantine and things has driven people indoors, but it was obviously occurring well before this. And it's not just simply because of that. People are also, you know, with distracted drivers and the amount of people that are getting hit by cars out there, cyclists that are being hit, people are feeling just a lot more safe training indoors. And you can design it and find your time and build your own sort of, you know, training cave for pain cave for how you're going to do your workouts. You know, I believe that you can get a lot of, you know, you can get physically really well adapted to the demands of racing by training indoors and using some of the platforms that are out there, such as Zwift and others. But I also believe that there's definitely value in going outdoors and just experiencing riding your bike outdoors. And some of it is training, some of it is for skills, some of it is for motivation, inspiration, all those type of things. So I think being able to marriage the two is valuable. And that's what you're seeing is, I would say there's very few people that go, I only train indoors. And there are some people that do for a multitude of reasons, work, safety, all kinds of things. But I encourage people to make sure you're getting outdoors because you want to be a complete bike rider, you know, and there's nothing that you can emulate ripping down a long descent when you are the one that controls every aspect of that, whether you kind of live or die to getting to the bottom of that descent. You know, there's a lot of skills that are important for you to develop when you're outdoors riding. So I encourage people. And also I think ultimately I know that's what motivates me when I can get outdoors and do a great workout and still do my indoor workouts when needed, especially if I'm doing a really intense interval session, then I'll do it indoors because then there's virtually no distractions. I have no excuses.
Right.
I kind of get through it. But I think marrying those two is critical.
What about the strength training piece? Do you guys implement strength training? Is that more of an off-season thing? I know as I've gotten older, I try to put both in play because structurally, you know, we've all crashed a million times on bikes, on skis, and life and everything, right? And I notice if I start just doing endurance training, I can feel the creaks and, you know, the soreness skeletally. But I don't know, you know, if that's an anomaly or what. But do you guys talk about strength training? Do you implement strength training? How does that, you know, become part of a training plan?
Yeah, that's a great question. I prefer to call it resistance training. Okay. It needs to be part of an athlete's training program. Especially as we age, you know, I mean, Ken, you're in your 20s, so you don't have to worry about this.
Exactly.
But as we age, you know, we end up sitting behind a desk and driving the desk we lose flexibility, a more static position that we stay in most of the day, agility, coordination, all those things are really critical to incorporate into your resistance training. And I think what we try to do is not isolate particular muscle movements. We try to engage a lot more muscle into movements, into resistance movements. You may not sit there and isolate it and, hey, I'm going to, you know, get my, you know, my biceps all pumped up by doing curls. Well, that's probably not going to help you a lot beyond just getting, you know, big biceps, but doing a lot of core work that puts you a little bit off balance, that engages all the muscles that are involved in helping stabilize your core is really critical for an athlete, especially as we age, because we start to lose muscle tone as we age, bone density, those type of things. So, but there's a lot of emerging science now that is also showing that there's gains from for elite athletes as well, elite cyclists as well, by doing resistance training. When I was an athlete, it was really frowned upon, and it was kind of looked like, well, cyclists don't lift weights, and you don't do any of that. And now in the pro peloton, that has changed, and you're seeing a lot more resistance training, strength training, athletes that are doing it year round, not just in the designated off season, year round, and incorporating it. And I think it's the evolution of training overall from where we were when I started in the 60s to where we are now, you know, in 2020, it just has to be part of your training program. You cannot, just simply do endurance work without some form of resistance training.
No, and it's almost across all sports, right? You look at even golfers now, you look at people that you would never think, and that's becoming a major component of their training in order to stay strong, to stay fit. But as much as it's strength training too, once you break through the initial soreness, it helps with mobility as well. And that's what is really a big piece of a lot of sports, I know, especially as I'm getting age. Now that I'm 23 versus 21, I'm noticing the difference, but no.
One thing that's critical with that, Ken, is also recognizing, you know, you only have a certain amount of time,
right,
to train every day, especially if you're a time crunch athlete, you know, and so you have to balance what gains you can make through the strength training versus endurance training, you know, and training on the bike. And so it's balancing between those gains. Generally, if you're an endurance athlete, if you're a cyclist, you're going to get your greatest gains to help your performance on the bike by what you're doing on the bike, the type of that you're doing. But we want to incorporate some strength/resistance training so that you're staying mobile, you're staying, you know, agility, helping reduce some possible injuries, and also being able to make sure that power that you're gaining on the bike is all going to the pedals and making yourself go forward. So we need to balance it, but it's like anything, if you kind of veer too far to one side of any particular form of training, then you're going to have deficiencies over here as well. So that balance is always critical.
Perfect. Now, balance is critical in life, right? All aspects of it. And if you can achieve it and figure it out or do the best you can, I think that's goal number one.
Absolutely.
But Chris, you know, we're coming up here on 35 minutes. Thank you for being part of this. Where can people find out more about you? Where can they find out more about CTS? Give yourself, you know, a great plug and opportunity to reach out to people.
Sure. Love to have you all come and visit trainright.com. That's our website. You can also find us on Facebook, CTS on Facebook. Instagram is trainright_news. Our Twitter is trainright on Twitter. You can find us on all the social media platforms. Love to have people stop by and say hello.
Perfect. And again, Chris, this was awesome. Thank you for your insight. We could probably go for hours and hours because I just try to ask the questions that intrigue me. And I figure that if a lot of the listeners have the same questions I have, so it's sort of down that road. But thank you for being part of this. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Ken.
And if anyone has any questions, comments, feedback, wants to reach out, email me at kenneththeexecutiveathletes.com. Make sure you make it through this COVID situation. But like Chris is saying, keep training, try to figure something out and stay active. And hopefully you can get outside, because riding your bike outside, there is nothing better. So thanks again.